Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Miller is a medical oncologist specializing in pain and palliative care, and he serves as the Director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, we welcome Dr. Tom Rutherford. Dr. Rutherford is Chief of Gynecologic Oncology and Associate Professor of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at Yale School of Medicine, and he joins Ken Miller to talk about ovarian cancer.
Well, firstly, what is ovarian cancer, and are there different types of it?
There are different types of ovarian cancer. And basically, it is a disease of the ovary. It can be seen in the young, such that you can have teenagers. The earliest recorded is age 8. Up until the age of about 30, 35, where you start seeing what's called a germline ovarian cancer. These are tumors that grow very fast. They grow in the ovary. The young ladies often look pregnant within a couple weeks. If you developed one of these tumors prior to the age of, or prior to 1970, they were fatal. Today, it is very rare to have a lady die of this disease. It does require a surgery, take the ovary out, the affected tissue out. It's a conservative surgery, so the patient should be able to go on and have children, and then it requires chemotherapy.
And let me ask you a little bit more about that. So is this the most common type?
For children, it is.
For children.
For children. It's a germline tumor.
And that would be called a germline tumor. So, for example, I've, just in my own personal life, we've had a neighbor whose daughter was 14 when she developed an ovarian cancer. But that's different than
that would be a germline tumor.
Okay.
That's a germline.
All right. And that kind, you're saying, it sounds like it's a very curable disease.
It's curable and very rare, thank God.
Okay. There's also, I wanted to ask you, too, before we start talking about the most common, there's something called a ovarian cancer or tumor of low malignant potential. What does that mean?
Well, it is a cancer. And there's different types of it, but what it basically is a surgical exercise. And that is a tumor that doesn't show a lot of invasion into the basement membranes of the cells. However, it also does not respond to chemotherapy. So it's a surgical exercise to take the tumor out. The tumor can recur, and it can have what's called micrometastatic ability, so that a patient could get in trouble. But most of the time, you are able to, they're localized within the ovaries, you can surgically remove them, and most of the time, you don't have a problem with the tumor.
Now, when you go to operate on a patient, do you know ahead of time what kind of cancer or what kind of tumor you're dealing with?
The only differential you're going to have is where the age breaks. So if you have somebody 35, 40, or 35 or less, you're thinking that is probably going to be a germ cell tumor. If they're 40 or more, then you start thinking that it's the epithelial tumor, and that's the more common tumor that we do encounter.
Now, because a lot of these women, you're specifically mentioning women around 35 or 40, a lot of are at childbearing age. And are there situations where you can preserve fertility for women with various types of cancer?
Yes, there are. We've had some people, even every now and then you get this epithelial tumor that shows up in the younger women in the age 30, 35 group. If it's localized within an ovary, we will take that ovary out, maintain the uterus, the other ovary, still many times treat them with chemotherapy and observe them at that point.
Okay. So what is the most common type of ovarian cancer, and what would be a typical way that a woman would present to the doctor?
The most common is the epithelial tumors. That's the tumor we think like Gildner-Radner.
Mm-hmm.
Those tumors often are present for 2 years, up to 2 years before we diagnose them. And the problem with the tumor or the ovarian cancer is that it's a disease that whispers, such that you go out to dinner and have some spaghetti sauce and your stomach's upset. But it goes away in a day or two. And a couple weeks later, you have a little symptom, but you're working out at the gym. And that goes on for 6 months, a year, and then you finally get examined. They don't see anything. And then over about the last maybe 5-6 weeks before the patient comes to us, they found a lot of abdominal bloating, decreased appetite, change in their bowel or their bladder function. And at that point, it's obvious something's going on. But unfortunately, this tumor is very indolent and very quiet. It's there. It's giving you signs, but it's backward looking at it that you figure it out.
You know, with those symptoms, I'm just wondering when a woman eventually is found to have ovarian cancer, I mean, besides obviously being worried and scared, are they upset? Are they angry? Are they mad at themselves or doctors? Or, you know, what's the feeling, the emotion?
Many times these patients have seen 3-4 physicians before they come to us. So they're disappointed in the medical system for not identifying these tumors up front. They're disappointed that they didn't act more proactively. But the real problem is a lot of times you can see a patient. The ovaries are normal. They're very small. They're not becoming enlarged, and yet they have disease going on. And we've operated on people with symptoms. Laparoscopically, you look, you see nothing, you take the ovary out or a piece of what's called the omentum, and you find disease in the omentum. So it's a lot of this is microscopic that in the early stages that you're not going to see.
So this really isn't even with the best technology, the you know, experts like yourself examining women, and even looking in, you're saying that everything looks okay.
We've been fooled.
Yeah, yeah. With men, I mean, you and I are able to have a PSA drawn and have a prostate exam, and that's a, you know, how, and prostate cancer is being found early. What progress has been made in terms of finding ovarian cancer?
Well, in the past, the CA125 was the big test. The CA125 and the ultrasound is basically what we had for screening, and neither one of them really improved detection. Every now and then, you got lucky. However, we've, in the laboratory, been playing with the test that looks at 6 different protein markers. And this is currently being marketed by LabCorp. That is a serum test, and it's being looked at women who have a family history or a suspicion for ovarian cancer. And hopefully this will help in detection. It's just recently come out. There is some controversy about it. It needs to be put through a big pilot study in the sense that we need, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 people or 100,000 people to see how are we really going to do. But so far, the test has been holding up relatively well. We are able to identify some people who have a very early ovarian cancer. It's not 100%. None of them are. But the real numbers, we're going to have to wait a little while.
You know, with that in mind, so it sounds like eventually there may be a way to draw a blood test and detect
That's
it
correct.
Early. But now that, I mean, we're not quite there, what would represent very good? Who would you want to screen really carefully, and how would you screen them right now?
Well, we always talk about the BRCA 1 and 2 population, the Ashkenazi Jewish population, and that helps. If you're from that lineage, you have a family history of a BRCA 1 or 2 positive disease, that's fine. My family history, I have 2 uncles with pancreatic cancer. I have an aunt with breast cancer and 2 aunts with ovarian cancer, all BRCA 1 and 2 negative, all on my mother's side. It doesn't have to be your mother's side. It can be coming out of your father's side. So basically, the tumors that ride together are ovarian, breast, uterine, colon, prostate, and pancreatic. That increases your risk. If you have a BRCA 1 and 2 defect, that helps because now you can go and screen the rest of the family. And if they also have the defect, then they're at a higher risk of developing one of those tumors. If they don't have a defect or a deletion, then you have the problem. Now, we're playing in the laboratory with an entity called microRNA. MicroRNAs are little RNAs. It's a little bit different. It's not used in transcription and translation into protein. What it does is help regulate the cell. And we found that some of the RNAs, these microRNAs, are missing in patients with ovarian cancer.
And now, let me ask you a little bit more about this. So we're talking about RNA, which is helpful.
MicroRNA.
MicroRNA. Well, tell us a little bit for the listening audience, for me too, because I'll admit my lack of knowledge. Tell us again, what does microRNA look like? What does it do?
They're short fragments of RNA, mm-hmm. and they help regulate the cellular function of how that cell, of how the genes work. There's only about 480 or so of these little microRNAs in the body that so far that we've detected. They seem to be able to be identified in tumors as a deletion or a single nucleotide polymorphism, a SNP. And we've been able to identify some of these abnormalities in the ovarian cancer, and they're very specific, which is kind of interesting.
Now, is this something that Is that something that if we were looked at these patients' cells, the other cells in the body, that this is something about them or something about the tumor?
We can actually use what's called a buccal smear mm-hmm. on the inside of a mouth and just on a swab be able to identify if you have that deletion. This is pretty relatively new. This is probably one of the hottest topics in science at the current time. And most of what's being published is just coming out over the last maybe 18 to 24 months.
So if you know someone based on family history or based on their genetics or eventually, let's say, based on microRNA, if you know someone's at high risk, what would constitute really top-notch screening for them?
Well, I think, one, the OverSure blood test from LabCorp we would use. We would use the ultrasound. We'd use the CA125. We would use, once we get the population figured out on the microRNA, we have a specific deletion that we know. And probably start looking that into a screening program as well. There is no one test that's going to do it. And even with the best of technologies, we're sure we're probably going to miss something. So the question comes down is how to manage that risk.
And, you know, who would you recommend surgery for? In other words, to prophylactically, I mean, remove the ovaries.
I think what you want to do is look at where the family history is. The prophylactic surgery you'd like to prefer to do around age 35. With the removal of the ovaries, you decrease the risk of an ovarian cancer. You decrease the risk of a breast cancer. But you do not decrease the risk of ovarian cancer to zero because there's an entity called a primary peritoneal cancer, which can occur even if you remove the ovaries. And it's just like an ovarian cancer because it's the same lining on the abdomen, inside the abdomen, as it is as that of the ovary. And the problem is when an ovary releases an egg during normal ovulation, a portion of that surface of the ovary ruptures and it's spread through the abdomen. And that in and of itself can cause little implants later if a tumor would develop. The other way to reduce the risk, or there's two ways to reduce the risk. One's going to be birth control pills, mm-hmm. and that seems to be very effective. And what we would want to do is put somebody on birth control very, very early. And you do that to prevent ovulation because we believe that the tumor is being caused by inflammation. So if you, during an ovulation cycle, you rupture the surface of the ovary, it undergoes a repair mechanism, and that inflammation that occurs, we believe, has some impact on malignancy. Where the theory falls apart a little bit is the other way to reduce the risk of ovarian cancer is by tubal ligation. Mm-hmm. That also decreases your risk of your breast cancer. Now, tubal ligation has nothing to do with ovulation. It interrupts Correct. The tube and the blood supplies going to the tube. So the question comes down is how does tubal ligation decrease the risk?
All right, what's the answer?
We do not know.
All right. Well, with that in mind, let's take a break. But when we come back, we're going to talk more about ovarian cancer. Again, you're listening to EL Cancer Answers. And I'm with Dr. Tom Rutherford, who is the Director of Gynecologic Oncology at the Yale Cancer Center.
Here in Connecticut, the American Cancer Society estimates that almost 1,000 people will be diagnosed with colorectal cancer every month. The good news is that when you detect it early, colorectal cancer is easily treated and highly curable. That means that if you're over the age of 50, you should have regular colonoscopies to screen for this disease. In the case of patients that develop colorectal cancer, there are more options than ever before thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for colorectal cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm here with Dr. Tom Rutherford, who's the Director of Gynecologic Oncology at the Yale Cancer Center. And we'd like to remind you, you can email questions to Yale Cancer Answers by sending them to canceranswers@yale.edu. And if you we'll try to answer them here on the air or a later date. Tom, actually, I want to ask you a personal question. I actually didn't know about your family history, which is that, I mean, what led you into gynecologic oncology? Was it related to that?
Actually, it wasn't.
Okay.
I did a PhD in molecular genetics. And I was looking at an enzyme called galactosyl transferase, and we were looking at in leukemia. And I accidentally worked with a gentleman out in Toledo, Ohio, who was a gynecologic oncologist on a young lady who had an ovarian cancer. And I said, well, this is pretty neat. And that time it was subtraction hybridization was the big technique. And I said, I could get normal ovary, abnormal ovary. I should be able to figure this out. I was a little naive. And that's actually what the night is for me to start.
Oh, that's interesting. And I have to say, I think it's with a lot of us, it's fascinating. But sometimes it is one patient or one mentor that we have. How is ovarian cancer treated?
It really depends upon the stage. If you find an early stage, we treat it predominantly surgery plus or minus chemotherapy. And anything beyond the early stage, it's basically going to be surgery and chemotherapy. And the question is, which do you do first? So in any tumor, if you just think about it, it's basically four stages of a tumor. It's stage one, it's basically confined to the organ. Stage four means it's metastatic, somewhere distant. Stage two, it's whatever organs are closer, and stage three is just a little farther away. And that's pretty much true for any tumor. So a stage one ovarian cancer is located within that ovary, and if it's what's called a well-differentiated tumor, the surface is not involved, we would take the ovary out, do a hysterectomy, do the lymph nodes along the major vessels in the abdomen and pelvis. There's a fat pad that hangs off the stomach called the omentum. We would remove that. If just the ovary is involved, we would stop. We would just treat the patient with surgery. She would not need chemotherapy. However, if it would be a high-grade tumor, meaning a poorly differentiated tumor, we would then go on and treat the patient with chemotherapy.
Now, of all the patients that you see, or gynecologic oncologists see in general, what percentage have these very early tumors that are well differentiated?
Unfortunately, very few. So you're probably looking at 10-15%.
All right. And those women, it sounds like many of them are cured surgically.
That's correct.
All right. And for women who don't fit that criteria, let's say who have, again, early stage, maybe you're talking about stage one or stage two, but it's not, the tumor looks a little more wild underneath the microscope. What would be the sequence of events for them?
The lady would still undergo the surgery. You do the hysterectomy, do the lymph nodes, do the omentum, remove any tumor you saw, and then the patient would receive chemotherapy. The current chemotherapy we're using today is a platinum taxane base, and plus or minus a drug called Avastin, which affects the vasculature to the tumor. It looks like Avastin is going to be moved up into front line. It looks like it has a major advantage for the patients. And there's several clinical trials run currently in the nation. One is being run by a gynecologic oncology group, and they're looking at Avastin advanced stage disease. And the second one is run by Genentech on recurrent disease, that they're bringing it as a second line therapy. And both of these trials are showing that there seems to be some advantage to moving this drug up. And I think in the future, you're going to see platinum, taxane, and Avastin, or an Avastin-like compound.
And might that be the case even for women with early?
I think it's going to be, yes. I mean, if you can improve your advanced stage, you want to improve your early stage. Because even an early stage has a 20% recurrence rate.
And you know what? Just in other parts of oncology, the same thing is happening. It's, in terms of lung cancer treatment, colon cancer treatment, you're absolutely right about in terms of Avastin being a very exciting drug. Now, there's another approach being used in other types of cancer where you actually treat someone up front. You use a chemotherapy first. When might that be useful in your field?
Well, actually, the neoadjuvant chemotherapy was started with Peter Schwartz.
Mm-hmm.
And he, remarkably, when I came here in 1993, I saw a lady with a very advanced cancer. He asked me what we would do. I said we'd go to the OR, and he promptly told me I was wrong. I said, okay. So we treated her with chemotherapy. Then we went to the OR. Now, when a lady comes in with advanced tumors or advanced stage disease, she has a abdominal bloating, a lot of fluid in the abdomen. A lot of times they can have fluid in their lungs. And you take them to the OR, all the tissue is soggy. It's like putting your hands in dishwater for a week. So you have an increased bleeding. The patient would often end up in intensive care for a prolonged period of time. And probably, depending on who you want to believe, is somewhere between 60 and 80% of the time you can debulk the patient to no residual disease, and that's in the best of hands.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get trials to show you any number you want. But that patient ultimately has a pretty rocky course. They reaccumulate the fluid in the abdomen post-surgically, and you're always chasing them in intensive care, and they're pretty sick. The other thing's true is with the advanced stage disease, that patient has not been eating all that well, so her protein status is very poor. So if I can get that patient to eat, rebuild her protein status, get rid of the fluid, decrease the volume of tumor, that would decrease my operative time, that would make her postoperatively recover faster, and reduce my blood loss. So we treat them with chemotherapy up front. And what we've been able to show over the last 15 years is if you have a stage 4 tumor in a patient, the proper way to treat that patient is to treat that patient with chemotherapy up front, because we have increased survival if we treat that patient up front with chemotherapy prior to surgery. If it's a stage 3, meaning that it's bad, but it's not the worst, then if you can debulk that tumor, and we use CAT scan criteria to determine that, if you can, that is fine, then you treat them with chemotherapy. If you cannot debulk the tumor to no residual disease, and that's what we're looking to do anytime we go to the OR, is remove all tumor, then that patient should probably be treated with chemotherapy up front, followed by surgery.
Now, when you talk to women about using chemotherapy up front instead of operating, and we have these discussions in breast cancer as well, I mean, what do women typically say to you? What are the concerns they have?
Right. Well, ovarian cancer, the standard of care, if you had asked this 10 years ago, the standard of care was to treat the patient with surgery followed by chemotherapy. A gynecologic oncologist, not all of us do our own chemotherapy or do the chemotherapy. A lot of times we send the patient into medical oncology. Like Memorial Sloan Kettering, they have a split division on who's doing what. So if you go see the gynecologic oncologist, he's going to tell you to operate. In fact, that's exactly what they push.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I can take the disease out of patients. The question is it the right thing to do? So when you look at recovery time, how the patient does long term, that's what really drives us. And we have a very frank discussion of how well our patients do and how long or short they're going to spend in the hospital, and how the post-operative recovery time is.
You were saying that it looks like survival may be better in those patients who get pre-operative therapy. Is that because the post-operative course is easier, or do you think it really may, in fact, improve, get rid of more cancer cells?
We have a theory.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In the laboratory under Gil Moore, we've been able to identify what we are calling the stem cell. That stem cell is chemo-resistant. So when you treat an ovarian cancer, the biggest problem you have is over time that crazy disease comes back. We can get you no residual disease. It can stay dormant for a couple years. And then, unfortunately, many times it comes back. The cell that's coming back is what we believe is we're going to call the stem cell. It's a chemo-resistant cell. So if I treat a patient with chemotherapy, I kill all the soldier cells, leave the chemo-resistant cell behind, and at the time of surgery, we can remove it. And I think that might be what's happening.
Now, I have to say, your department and you and Gil Moore in particular have really been leaders with other members like Dr. Schwartz in terms of treating women with resistant ovarian cancer. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about some of the work that you're doing.
We've looked in the past on a drug called phenoxidiol. What happens on a chemotherapy, it works for a while and then it stops working. So the question is, did the cell figure out how not to undergo self-death called apoptosis, or can we modulate that mechanism to make it reactivate? We came up with a drug in the laboratory called phenoxidiol that we found, if you use that in the lab and even in the clinical trials, it seems to have an effect of chemo-resistant reversal. And we went from a clinical trial Phase 1, Phase 2, and currently we're on a multinational trial, Phase 3, looking at phenoxidiol in combination with chemotherapy to see if we can reverse the resistance. And so far we've had some encouraging results.
Now, how about just looking back in the last 10 years, I mean, the combination you're talking about, the Taxol or the taxane and the platinum drug, have been used for quite a while. I mean, is there and you mentioned Avastin. Any other drugs that are proving to be useful that may take the place of these other two?
I think what we're going to see is probably biologic modifiers being used. And I think that's actually where the push is going to come. And there's a lot of different trials currently everybody's looking at. I don't think anybody has anything to say this is going to be the next drug that we're going to use. There are other drugs. We look at topotecan, gemcitabine. Doxil is a very nice drug in the sense that it's been repackaged from Adriamycin so that you don't have the cardiotoxicities. But a lot of older drugs that we use. And in fact, we've gone back and started to use a drug, Alcoran, mm-hmm. Which everybody's surprised on line 13 or 14 works.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like there's also a large number of women who are living with cancer.
Correct. We have many people that we keep treating off and on chemotherapy. I have patients out anywhere from 8 to 12, 15 years with on chemotherapy off and on.
Is that, and leading a relatively good life?
Very good life. Yeah. Yeah. Quality of life is very important.
Tom, what other clinical trials are you involved in your department?
We're members of the Gynecologic Oncology Group. So we run, that's a multinational group of GYN oncologists. There are multiple trials that we have. A lot of them phase three, some phase one and two, to see which drug combination seems to have the best effect. We also do a lot of industrial trials. We work with Genentech, GlaxoSmithKline. We have some in our own homebred trials that we're looking at. We have a series of trials that are in design because we think we can knock out that stem cell mm-hmm. by playing with one of the receptors between the cell membranes. Mm-hmm. And if that holds true, I think that's going to be where the real breakthrough. It works in the animal model. If we can get it to work in the person, I think we got this one.
Yeah, one of the things I'm impressed with, I probably at the start of my career, a lot of times surgeons would say, I got it all, and a lot of diseases like breast cancer are treated very much surgically. But it sounds like really what you're talking about is it's a collaborative effort.
Oh, absolutely. The problem with this, when ovary ovulated and that cell ruptures, like rupturing a balloon, it just bursts through the abdomen. When we say we got it all, that means that we took out everything we can see. Problem is what we can't see. And we've all taken out an ovary or a piece of tissue that looks totally normal. You put it on a microscope and it's completely malignant.
Yeah. So ultimately, it's really a matter of you remove as much as you can to your vision.
Correct.
And feel. And then really the rest is using chemotherapy and some of these newer agents.
Correct.
Has the prognosis for women with ovarian cancer improved? Mm-hmm. Since the start of your career, for example?
I would tell you the actual cure rate may not have improved all that much. I think it's improved a little. Mm-hmm. But what you're definitely seeing is women are living much longer with the disease and as a functional life. It's sort of we're turning it in a little bit closer to diabetes. We didn't cure diabetes.
Correct.
But people are living longer and more functional lives of it.
As we're wrapping up, let me just ask you, how do women avail themselves of being involved in clinical trials, whether it be here at Yale or elsewhere?
I would encourage people to participate in a lot of these trials. Looking at these trials, the only way to get Avastin today mm-hmm. for an ovarian cancer is on a clinical trial. So since we know that drug has activity, some people will say, I don't want to be the guinea pig. You want to be the guinea pig for this trial. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying you do all trials, but sit down and talk with your physician. I think most physicians are going to be very honest with you and say, I would do this trial if I were you mm-hmm. or if this was my family member. This is good because.
Right.
I ask them why the good is. A lot of the trials we're doing today are bringing the drugs that I can't get you any other way.
All right. And, along those lines, there's very careful monitoring on clinical trials. And I think the other gift I think patients are giving is giving knowledge to science, to medicine, so that hopefully other women will benefit from along with them as well.
That's correct.
So anyways, I would like to, Tom, I want to thank you for joining us. It's been a very, very interesting session, as it always is when you come. Until next week, this is Dr. Ken Miller from the Yale Cancer Center wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions, comments, or would like to subscribe to our podcast, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find transcripts of past broadcasts in written form. Next week, Dr. Francine Foss talks to Ken Miller about the latest developments in the treatment of lymphoma. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.